Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation with Marist College President David Yellen. David Yellen is the fourth president of Marist College. He previously served as dean and professor of law at Loyola University, Chicago's School of Law, for 11 years. Prior to his position at Loyola, he was a member of the faculty of Hofstra Law School, holding the Max Schmertz Distinguished Professorship and serving as dean. He was also the Reuchlein Distinguished Visiting Professor at Villanova University School of Law and was a visiting professor at Cornell Law School and New York Law School. President Yellen's major area of academic expertise is criminal justice. He has written widely about these issues, advised President Bill Clinton's transition team on white-collar crime, and argued a federal sentencing case before the United States Supreme Court. He served as a volunteer special master at the request of Chicago's chief criminal court judge, examining claims of torture against a former Chicago police commander. President Yellen also served on the Illinois Sentencing Policy Advisory Council, was a member of the board of directors of Cook County Justice for Children. President Yellen earned his B.A. magna cum laude from Princeton University, his J.D. cum laude from Cornell Law School. After law school, he clerked for a federal judge, practiced law in Washington, D.C., and served as counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives. President Yellen's wife, Leslie Richards Yellen, serves as the Director of Inclusion for the Americas at Hogan Lovells, a multinational law firm. The couple, who met as law students at Cornell, have three adult daughters, Jordan, Meredith, and Bailey. We'll talk with Marist College President David Yellen about all of this and much more. But first, welcome, David Yellen.
Thank you, Alan. It's great to be here with you.
And it's great that you're here. You know, I spent a lot of time across the river down there at New Paltz, and Marist is a very respected institution.
As is New Paltz, obviously.
Isn't that nice of you to say? So anyway, let's get on with it. You were born where?
I was born in Jersey City, New Jersey.
Wow. Well, what about it?
Jersey City has changed a lot since I was born.
Yeah?
It's amazing, actually, to see how vibrant Jersey City has become now.
Yeah, I remember when I taught at Rutgers, I remember Jersey City, and that was a long time ago, didn't exactly enjoy the highest of reputations. So how long did you spend there?
Just a couple years, but I grew up in New Jersey my whole life. We lived in Ridgefield, then Paramus.
Yeah.
So New Jersey born and raised.
Yeah. And who's the most famous author from New Jersey?
The most famous author, well, with a loose definition of author, I would definitely say Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, well, that would be singing author.
Joyce Kilmer?
Actually, I was thinking of Philip Roth.
Oh, of course. And in fact, my grandfather knew Philip Roth's grandfather.
And they both took the Q44 bus into New York City, which was a very erotic time, and I can't go further than that.
Roth grew up in Newark, I believe.
He did.
And my family was from Jersey City, and people actually used to walk between Jersey City and Newark back then. And somehow my grandfather knew his father.
And what did your grandfather do?
My grandfather owned a butcher shop on Central Avenue in Jersey City.
Was it a kosher butcher?
It was not a kosher butcher shop.
Yeah.
But long, long time he owned it.
Do you have any memories of that butcher shop?
I do. I remember going in there as a kid. I remember two things about it. One, they used to have sawdust on the floor,
oh, yes.
I guess to absorb the blood, something that's not allowed nowadays under current health regulations. And the other was walking into that meat locker freezer. It had a particular loud click sound when you opened and closed it. It was so cold, and there were these sides of beef hanging up there.
Rocky.
They're sort of like Rocky, except no one punched the sides of beef, as far as I know.
Yeah. So you went to public schools?
I did.
And what was that like?
That's the only thing I knew. I think growing up, I knew one kid who went to private school. So, you know, I went to public high school in Paramus, and it was great. It was big public high school. Big schools have some challenges, but it was a great environment to go to high school.
What do you remember about high school?
What do I remember about high school? Wow. I haven't been asked that in a long time. Remember my friends? Remember sports? Played a lot of sports. I remember.
You did? What sports?
I played football all through high school and dabbled a little bit in track and earlier basketball, but football was the thing. I was a varsity player.
Should football be eliminated? It's too dangerous.
I am not there in my mind yet, but I have real concerns about it. I think football is probably safer today than it was 10 or 20 years ago, both because of the technology and the helmets, and probably even more so the concussion protocols. I had a couple of concussions, I know, as a high school football player. Maybe that explains some things about me today, maybe not. So, you know, I'm not ready to say we should ban football, but it's a real concern.
Yeah. So then after high school, what happened?
I went on to college. I went to Princeton.
Oh, Princeton.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what was that like? It had a sort of reputation as being a little stuffy.
Yeah, so I went in 1975, and it had changed a lot from the old Princeton, but it still had a lot of the feel of the time when the F. Scott Fitzgerald crowd really dominated the place. So those of us who were from public school environments, especially those of us whose parents hadn't graduated from college, it was definitely a bit of an alien environment that took some adjusting to. On the other hand, the academics were unbelievable. You know, small classes, great professors. I made many lifelong friends there. So I loved it. I have great memories of it, great respect for it. But it was a bit of a jolt at the time.
Did they still have things like the eating clubs?
They had the eating clubs, although many of them had by then gone co-ed, non-selective. So they were still called eating clubs, but they were nothing like the old ones. Although there were a few like the old ones. In fact, I was a bit of a rabble-rouser. I wrote an independent paper one year about the relationship between the university and the all-male private eating clubs. And I wasn't a lawyer yet, but I did this legal analysis and concluded that that relationship violated New Jersey law. Eventually, a young woman a year or two younger than me protested the all-male eating clubs, and some guys threw her in a fountain, did some awful stuff. And that ultimately, what she did, ultimately led to the banning of the all-male clubs.
So now, as a Jewish guy from New Jersey, we know that some of these places had quotas. It had to be hard to get into Princeton, as I say, as a Jewish guy from New Jersey.
In the 50s, there were definitely spoken or unspoken quotas about Jews. I honestly don't think there was anything like that by the time I got there in the 70s. There were lots of Jewish kids in my class, and I don't think it existed anymore at that time.
Were you a political science major?
I was.
Yeah. And what was that like?
I love that. That's where I got interested in criminal justice. And actually, Princeton called it politics because they were a little reluctant to think of it as a science. So they wanted to keep the emphasis on sort of the human aspect of the field. And that's a broad field, and lots of people within that pick different concentrations. I got really interested through volunteer work I did at a juvenile prison in juvenile justice and criminal justice reform. So kind of crafted my own sub-major within that field with the help of a great professor, and it affected the rest of my life, really.
Wow. Well, you know, I worked, my first job was down at Rutgers at the Eagleton Institute of Politics, and I was there for several years and very good. And we always looked up the hill at Princeton.
Well, I had many high school friends who went to Rutgers. I spent a lot of time there. One of my daughters has a degree from Rutgers, a graduate degree, so it's a place I know and love too.
That's great. You haven't made a mistake yet, David Yellen. I'm trying to get you into trouble, but I haven't been able to do that
yet. All right, give me a few minutes. I know I can pull that off.
Yeah. Okay. So then you go to Princeton, you major in political science, and next up?
Well, I was leaning towards law school, but knew I didn't want to do that right away. So I had two fabulous years between college and law school, something I highly recommend to people thinking about graduate studies. Go do something else for a while. So a high school friend and I bought a beat-up old van and traveled the country.
What was the brand of the van?
It was a Ford Econoline.
Okay.
I remember that. And we traveled the country, picked up jobs along the way. We worked on a farm, in a restaurant, in a parking garage, and went to national parks and just had a great experience.
Did you pick up anything else along the way?
Just a bad cold once. Uh-huh. That's it. And then I wound up being in VISTA, Volunteers in Service to America, today known more as AmeriCorps, in San Francisco. I worked for an organization that did work on juvenile rights, children's rights issues, and that was a great experience and really solidified my interest in going to law school.
So you took 2 years off. Were your parents still with us at that time?
They were.
And did they approve of those 2 years off?
They were completely supportive, and you know, it was so great of them because not everybody would have been. In fact, my friend, his parents were very nervous about it. Now, he went on also to go to law school and become a major partner in a major, you know, he's had a phenomenal career. But they were worried that he was going to, you know, maybe fall in love with being a busboy or something like that. And my parents, to their credit, just they trusted me that I'd figure it out. And they were nervous because there were no cell phones. And here we were driving across the country. They might not hear from me for a week or two. But other than that, they were absolutely great about it.
Now, we know your grandfather had the butcher shop. What did your father do?
My father was in the insurance business, life insurance, pensions, uh-huh. things like that.
Uh-huh. And did your mom work?
She did. She worked from the time my younger brother was three. She wound up being the vice president of this company that manufactured desk calendars, pocket calendars, and all sorts of related things to that. She was head of marketing and advertising, worked her way up from being a secretary to being a vice president.
Has your mom's career influenced you about the way you think about women? I mean, my mother was the major breadwinner in our family and ran the West Side. And so I always thought of, you know, women placing the home and stuff. We would have starved.
Yeah, well, you know, my parents were so far ahead of their time in being a completely equal partnership. They both worked. They both did housework. They both raised the kids. So they couldn't.
Did they both cook?
They did both cook, although my dad was a bit of a better cook than my mom.
Okay, so there you go, and now you have to decide which law school you're going to, right? And how did you do that?
Gosh, you know, you applied a bunch of places. I was thinking about staying in California, and my parents were weighing in that I hoped I came back east. And at that point, for whatever reason, I don't remember why, I thought I would rather be in a less urban area to be a reflective law student. And so Cornell, I visited, and I'd been there before and loved the place.
Yeah. Well, I had two children and my money that went to Cornell. And I have a daughter who, after that, went to Princeton, of all places, to do a PhD. So
good for her.
Certain amount of commonality.
Absolutely.
Coming through here. David Yellen is the fourth president of Marist College. And we're talking to him. And I'm delighted that you're here, David. It's just fun. So what happened in law school? Or as we say in my family, and then what happened?
Not a lot of people say they love the first year of law school, but I did. I love the intellectual structure and the way it taught you to think through problems. So I really liked the first year of law school. It was very exciting. After that, honestly, law school got a little boring, too much of the same thing. Law schools are a lot better today at having a broader range of experiential learning after the first year. But the best thing that happened after the first year of law school is that my wife and I started dating.
Did you meet her in class?
Well, we met outside of class, but we were in a class together.
What was the class?
The class was contracts.
Oh, yeah. And so did you start to sit next to each other?
No, it was more like, I wish she were here to tell this story. She's on a business trip. But this professor was the only throwback mean guy professor we had. If you ever saw The Paper Chase.
I was just going to ask you.
Oh, yeah. He was cut from that mold.
Right.
And a lot of people were intimidated by him.
But did he have a heart of gold underneath his
rough? Not that anyone knew. And I not that anyone ever found out, honestly. And he scared a lot of people. But for whatever reason, I kind of, on an intellectual level, I connected with him. And he often called on me or I volunteered. And Leslie will tell you that she was sitting more in the back. I was more in the front. And she took a lot of notes based on things I said in class. And it kind of helped her figure things out in the class. So she actually sought me out to meet me. And you see me here. If you saw my wife, you'll know that she was out of my league terms of dating material. But happily, she introduced herself to me, and the rest is history.
Well, a little bit more on the history. At what point did it move from, you know, classroom respect to, you know, something more romantic?
Well, that's awfully personal at this time.
Well, that's what I'm known for.
During our second year of law school.
Yeah.
And we've been together ever since. May will be 31 years.
Did you bring her home to meet your parents?
Oh, absolutely.
How'd that go?
That went fine. You know, to inject a more somber note here, by the time she met my parents, my mom had just been diagnosed with cancer, which she died from 9 months later.
Oh, boy.
So she never had a chance to really get to know my mom. My dad and she hit it off very quickly and, you know, loved each other the rest of my dad's life.
And how about the other way around? You over to her parents.
So she was from the Midwest. And, you know, I flew to...
Or as the old joke goes, what's the matter? Haven't you ever seen a Yankee before?
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, they were great. We were very different people in a lot of ways. But again, we're very lucky. I had a really loving relationship with her mom. We were extremely close till she passed away. And her dad's still alive, and we're all very close.
Yeah, that's great. So you did it cautiously. There was never a raised eyebrow about you.
Oh, I don't know about never a raised eyebrow. You know, her dad is a very tradition-minded guy, and I'm a very informal person. So the first time I flew out there, I think he was expecting me to show up in, you know, a tweed jacket with patches and that kind of thing. Back to the old Princeton.
Sure.
And I showed up in, it was summer, I showed up in shorts and a t-shirt. So he had to get over that, but he did.
We are talking to David Yellen, the fourth president of Marist College. Now, you meet in law school, you marry, and then what happens?
On the personal side or the professional side?
Anyway, you want to take it.
Well, let's go professional for now. As you read in my bio, I clerked for a judge for a year, which was a very interesting experience.
Which judge?
So Leslie, as I mentioned, is from the Midwest. She originally thought she wanted to go back to the Midwest and took a job in Omaha, Nebraska.
Sure.
And I was able to get a clerkship with a federal judge in Omaha.
Was that hard? How do you get a clerkship?
Well, and, you know, and think this is obviously in the dark ages before email and all that.
Sure.
You wrote letters and judges wrote back and you go in for an interview and then they decide who they want to offer the job to.
So tell us a little about the judge.
His name is, he's still alive, he's in his 80s, Arlen Beam. He was from Nebraska, had been a seed corn salesman, and then went on to law school, wound up becoming counselor, lawyer for the governor, one of the governors of Nebraska, and then got appointed to the bench. Very good man, very sensible judge.
On my political science exams that I gave to the kids all those years, I always said, name the one state with a unicameral legislature. And then there was Nebraska.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I think a lot of people would love to know how it works when you're a clerk. I mean, some clerks do a lot of work. Some clerks do much less work. Were you kept busy?
Well, all law clerks I've ever known have done a lot of work. The difference is how judges use their clerks. You know, judging is kind of a lonely business, right? Because you have your courtroom, you're hearing cases, making decisions. You don't really have regular colleagues to talk to on an ongoing basis. So the law clerks become extremely important in the judge because often those are the sounding boards for the judge on cases and decisions to make. So judges and clerks talk a lot about the pending cases. Clerks do research and write memos with background about the law.
And this is not an appellate.
No, this was a federal trial level, which is different than an appellate level.
Sure.
Yeah, because we had trials and the judge had to sit and, you know, and preside over the trials and make evidentiary rulings. He had some appellate responsibilities, too, from the bankruptcy court. So it was a little bit of both.
And did you have to sit in the courtroom and hear the case?
When it was a case that I was working on, but the judge had three clerks, and there weren't trials going on that much of the time, so I didn't spend much time in the courtroom.
Well, that's interesting. Okay, so you get through it.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
We moved to Washington and went to work for a law firm that did litigation, business litigation, and white-collar criminal defense, and I did that for a year and a half or so.
And did you defend anybody of personal angst to you? In other words, when you look back on your career and say, ooh, that was a tough one.
No, you know, I wasn't there long enough to get too deep into that kind of thing. And when you're a lawyer, look, any lawyer, you're going to have to represent people who you're not incredibly fond of. That just, if you're a lawyer, that goes with the territory. I, as a low-level associate, wasn't involved in choosing the clients or really interacting with the clients that much. So that wasn't really an issue for me. Later on in my career, when I was a professor and did some sentencing and appeals works, you know, there were clients I worked for who I felt strongly had gotten a raw deal, and I was enthusiastic about writing that. There were other clients who I was much less comfortable with, but they deserved legal representation to the best of my ability. Again, you choose to be a lawyer, and once you sign on to represent someone, it's your job not to judge them, but to represent them.
Can't be that easy.
You know, being a lawyer has an ethical and moral challenge to it because, you know, people often think about law and justice, but that's in the big picture. If our system works right, we achieve a lot of justice long term, right? But in the individual case, the only lawyer who really has an affirmative duty to pursue justice is a prosecutor. And a lot of them don't do that. A lot of them just try and win. But part of a prosecutor's responsibility is to do justice, not just to win.
So we're picking up the paper every day now, and we're finding a police sergeant, a police lieutenant, somebody who is responsible and who has ginned the evidence one way or another. Yeah. That must really gall you.
Sure. You know, as you mentioned in my bio, it sometimes gets worse than that. I work hundreds of hours as a volunteer for the Chicago Criminal Court investigating claims against a police commander who had not just made up evidence, but had tortured people, suspects, all African American, that he thought were guilty of serious crimes, and tortured them into confessing. And lots of those folks went to prison in a number of cases for things they didn't do. So any system of justice is going to be imperfect, and the pressures on prosecutors and police are great, but the system has to be rigorous in enforcing the rules and not allowing or winking and nodding at any kind of manufacturing of evidence or, you know, misleading behavior.
David Yellen, based on what we are seeing now and the kinds of abhorrent reports that we're getting about, you know, not only what you've just mentioned, torture, but just false testimony and the rest of it, do you have any sense about how riddled the whole system is?
It's impossible to answer because there's no way to get good data. I'd say a couple things. Some places are worse than others. So some police departments back in the day were sort of notorious for looking the other way about manufactured evidence and perjury. You know, Chicago does not have a good reputation in that regard. Certainly at one point, Philadelphia didn't have a good reputation in that regard. But I'll say that those problems, although they continue to exist and need to be fought every step of the way, I really do have a sense that that stuff is diminishing in light of the scrutiny that is now brought to bear in those kind of cases.
Well, we want to go back to your history. So there you are. Were you on a, what we would call in academic area, a tenure track at the law firm, a partner track, or were you, in fact, deciding as you were an associate that you don't want to do that?
Yeah, I sort of fairly quickly, I liked the firm and the people, but I sort of quickly realized that wasn't what I wanted to do with my life. At that point, I kind of decided I'd either go the government nonprofit route or the higher education route. And I went government first. I worked as a lawyer for the House Judiciary Committee.
Who was the chair then?
The chair of the committee, the whole committee, was the famous Peter Rodino, who,
one of the great heroes.
Yeah, for the younger viewers, look him up in connection with Watergate. He was a hero to any lawyer and most citizens. I didn't interact with him much at all because I worked for a subcommittee, the Subcommittee on Criminal Justice.
And who was the chair there?
The chair of that was Representative John Conyers from Detroit, who unfortunately has just been in the news recently and stepped down after some allegations on personal misconduct.
Wow. Okay. What did you learn when you did your time in Congress, David Yellen?
Well, I was a young, fairly idealistic person who believed in the need for a criminal justice system, but wanting to see reforms in the criminal justice system. And I happened to be there at the time when all of these really severe sentencing laws that are only now, almost 30 years later, being a bit unwound, when they were being enacted. So it was a time when most people in Congress were kind of jumping on each other's back to be the tougher on crime person. So it was kind of a frustrating time because for many of us thought that some of these laws were misguided and the problem of drugs and crime were serious, but that starting mass incarceration of drug offenders wasn't the way to go, but that's what was happening.
And that's what happened. And now we find some efforts. We're finding the number. I read a statistic the other day about how many African Americans, percentage-wise, have been caught up in this federal prison system. Do you have any sense of that?
Well, we still are in an era of mass incarceration. You know, our prison population is over 2 million in this country, and that went up by a factor of 7.
Is that the largest in the world?
Well, it's not only the largest in the world as a number. We're the largest in the world, or second, on a per capita basis. So in terms of industrialized Western countries, no one has an incarceration rate half or a third as high as ours. Some of it has to do, a lot of it has to do with how we treat drug crimes, but it's also how we treat, you know, more serious crimes as well. We send people to prison more often and for longer periods of time than, say, Western Europe does across the board. Violent crime, property crime, drug crime.
I want to ask you a personal question because I worked for this guy, Frank Thompson, who was abscammed from Trenton. And I believe to this day he didn't do it. But that's just the way it is. So the FBI sets up a sting operation and they put a phony sheik in one room and they put somebody in the other room, the FBI guys in the other room, and they offer him money. That has not been done since that time. Congress got so angry about it. Do you think there's some ethic or some ethos that creates that kind of an incentive to hold people responsible?
Well, there is a concept in the law known as entrapment, right? So there are limits to what the government can do. But just dangling some bait, so to speak, in front of someone and them taking the bait and committing a crime, that's not a violation of anything. They have to sort of be particularly persistent in how they try and induce someone to commit a crime that they weren't otherwise inclined to commit. It's a fine line. You know, it's a lot of gray areas. I haven't looked up abscam in a long time. I know that was certainly close to that line, if not over it. But it is a legitimate law enforcement tool to do undercover work, for example. And that sometimes involves seeing whether someone is interested in committing a crime.
David Yellen, we could talk about that one all day long. So there you are, House Judiciary Committee. You're interested in incarceration raids and criminal justice. What happens next?
Well, then I decided I thought I'd really like to become a law professor and teach and write in the criminal justice area. And I was lucky enough to be able to do that. And I began
How'd you do it?
There was a process back then. If you wanted to be a law professor, you applied and your name got put in a book that got sent around all the law schools. And there was a gathering at an airport hotel in Chicago where people interviewed. And then you got called back to schools if they were interested and you were interested. Real old-fashioned by today's standards process.
So where'd you go?
I went to Hofstra University Law School on Long Island.
Yeah. And what did you teach there?
I taught criminal justice and juvenile justice and white-collar crime and now, things like that.
I have a theory. Students often like professors who've done it as opposed to professors who read it out from, you know, a lecture that they've given a couple of years in a row. So with your experience, did you find that helped you in the classroom?
Well, in fact, I didn't have enough experience to be a really good professor. In hindsight, I should have been out 2-3 more years before I went into the classroom. And I'm a big believer that, especially in a professional field like law, you shouldn't become a professor till you've had a really good exposure to the practice. So I had 4 years, but in the early years, I not infrequently felt like I was at best one step ahead of the students.
Yeah, I remember that. So then the next thing is, where did you go from Hofstra?
Well, I spent 14 years as a professor at Hofstra.
That's a long time.
It was, and I loved it. And then I became dean of Hofstra Law School, and I did that for a while, and that was really interesting. And I stepped down, long story, but we were living outside of Philadelphia, where my wife had taken a job. And so I was doing a ridiculous commute and actually was hoping to get a job at Villanova. Got hired for a year in that hard-to-pronounce professorship at Villanova, and that was great. But then Loyola Chicago contacted me about an open deanship, and it just was time for an adventure, and I interviewed for the job, and we decided as a family and picked up and moved to Chicago.
And how many kids do you have?
Three. We have three daughters.
Three daughters, and have they all married off yet?
No, the oldest got married this year. She's 28.
Wow.
The middle one is 27 and is in medical school.
Wow.
And the youngest one is 23, and she's the budding academic in the group, and she's starting a PhD program in the fall.
Where at?
She's deciding right now.
Okay. So I guess I want to know about Marist. How did you get recruited to Marist?
Well, it's not uncommon for law school deans to become college presidents because the legal background helps sometimes, and also being dean of law school, you have an academic side and you have a fundraising side and an external side. So a number of my colleagues have gone that route. So the search firms that get hired by colleges to look for candidates are aware of law school deans. And if you're thought of having done a decent job as a law school dean, you're probably going to get contacted to see if you're interested. So after a long time as a dean, I began to think of next steps and I was thinking about being a professor again. But I had some interest in trying out being a president if the right situation came along. And one of these search firms contacted me about Marist, and I looked into it and, you know, got in the pool and wound up getting the job and accepting it.
So how does it work? They identify you, and then they send you and a couple of other candidates, I'm sure, to the search committee at the college or the university, right?
These days, typically, these searches are confidential, so the only people who know who the candidates are the people on the search committee, and that's typically a group of about 15.
Mm-hmm.
So they do an initial round of interviews. I don't know how many, maybe 8 or 9, typically. And then from that group, they'll usually choose, say, 3 finalists to come back for a more in-depth day and a half of discussions. That's how it worked here.
And David Yellen, when you arrived at the Marist campus for those interviews, did you learn anything from just talking to people about where you might be going?
Well, sure. The interview is a two-way process. You'd be making a big mistake just to accept a presidency or a deanship because it was offered. You've got to assess whether it's a place that fits with your values and your vision for higher education and whether it's got the kind of opportunities to succeed and develop. So I asked lots of questions of the search committee.
Do you remember any of the questions you asked?
Mostly I probably asked about their appetite for change. You know, the higher ed is in an unprecedented period of rapid change now. And the gap between the winners and the losers in education is getting broader. And if I was going to leave a place I loved to be a college president, I wanted to have a lot of confidence that this was a place that understood that complacency is death these days in higher ed. So that was what I probably asked the most questions about.
And so with that said, and I certainly agree with you, what are the greatest challenges that you face now that you're at Marist? I mean, how much does a college education cost a parent now?
Yeah, so private college tuition ranges from, you know, $20,000 to $60,000 a year, and then there's room and board on top of that, depending which college you're talking about. And the value proposition, as you say, has been questioned more now than ever. The evidence still shows that a college degree sets you up with much better life prospects. But at what level of expense and debt does that make sense? So that's one of the biggest challenges, is controlling costs, providing value. Simultaneously, young people are asking for more support than ever. When us older folks were in college, there weren't these wonderful offices of providing support to kids with learning disabilities, for example, and there weren't big public safety staffs often and things like that. The other challenge for those of us in the Northeast is that the demographics aren't in our favor. The number of high school graduates is not going to be rising in the next 20 years in the Northeast United States. So you have to be really appealing to people as a college to succeed, especially if you're one of the vast majority of colleges that aren't 200 years old with billion-dollar endowments.
So what's your biggest challenge? You have to go around and raise the money?
Yeah, I have to raise money, but Marist, under my predecessor's great leadership, you know, the model that they put in place was being very financially prudent, and so we're very strong operationally, so we need to raise a lot of money to build and expand in the future, but not to meet our current daily, monthly, yearly needs.
And so if you had to tell me what Marist is doing right, what would you tell me?
We're doing two things, at least two, really right. One is having a sort of campus environment and culture that makes students and their parents feel really good about attending there. It's a happy place. It's a beautiful place, supportive environment, and that matters a lot. Second, we continue to develop new programs in areas where there is a lot of student interest so that more students want to come to Marist. A lot of that development for us is now at the graduate level because we want to keep our undergraduate population at a size where it still feels like a reasonably small college. But we're adding new programs like in health sciences where there are jobs, and in technology, and even in things like fashion where the job market is good and where we attract great students.
There used to be a tremendous amount of competition between the private and the public sector in New York State. Big fights. I can't tell you the number of times I was before these microphones with a private college president who thought it really was, the game wasn't fair, was loaded. Do you feel any of that now?
Well, among the college presidents, the relationship is fabulous. In fact, we just had a dinner a couple weeks ago at the Vassar College president's house, and it was the Vassar president and myself and the president of New Paltz and the president of Dutchess Community College and the president of Mount St. Mary's. Five different colleges, two public, three private, and we were getting together to talk about ways we could cooperate more academically and do more for Poughkeepsie and the Hudson Valley. So you can't ask for much better cooperation than that. At a more macro level, you know, I'm here in Albany for some meetings of New York private college presidents, and a lot of what's coming out of the governor's office creates challenges for private higher ed. And
so, for example, he wants free tuition for certain numbers of students.
They have implemented that, and that's a really laudable goal. The way it was implemented has had some adverse effect on private colleges. They're now proposing taking away what's known as Bundy aid, which is money that New York for generations has provided to private colleges based on the number of graduates that you have. So there's some tension between private colleges and the state government. There's good cordial relations and conversations going on too, but I wouldn't want to say it's, you know, without its bumps.
And at the top of the heap here, we have the President of the United States, Donald Trump, and he has to be making certain decisions about academic institutions. Can you fathom for us or help us with what seems to be happening philosophically?
Well, the biggest thing regarding Washington and higher ed hasn't happened yet, and that's that it's time for a reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, which is the federal architecture for the whole system of higher ed in the country. And there's so many things being talked about. Honestly, there are things coming from both the right and the left that are potentially very troubling for colleges.
For example?
They're talking about restrictions on financial aid, depending on short-term views of job results for graduates. You know, I'm all in favor of accountability, but the use of metrics has to be done with subtlety and judgment, and some of the things that are being proposed are more, you know, of a blunderbuss kind of nature. In general, the funding levels for higher ed coming out of Washington are going down and are likely to go down considerably. Some of the things in the tax law, the new tax law, are a challenge for higher ed institutions.
How so?
Well, for example, this is one that doesn't affect Marist or most colleges, but this new law did impose a tax on endowments when the endowment is more than, I think it's $500,000 per student. And then also the new tax law restricts the deductibility of state and local taxes to a maximum of $10,000. And in a high tax state like New York, that results in a tax increase for lots of people and creates a disincentive to donate money to charity, you know, so there are a variety of things like that.
And Betsy DeVos is the education honcho in Washington. Is there anything that you find pleasant or even obnoxious about her?
Well, you know, it's been fairly quiet tenure for her, I think. She was very controversial as an appointment, of course, but I think that had more to do with her views on secondary and primary education and charter schools and teacher unions and things like that, which are outside of my realm.
Okay, so David Yellen, now I want to come to the kinds of things that a president has to do. For example, you have to make tenure decisions. You have an academic provost, I'm sure, who brings you stuff, but this has got to be a very tough time. I mean, I remember how tough it was for me.
Yeah, tenure, you know, places that have tenure track systems like Marist, the awarding of tenure is essentially a lifetime decision. So you want to make sure you get that right. It's a very democratic process. This isn't the president's decision. When someone is up for tenure, they're reviewed by a peer committee, they're reviewed by their department, their college, and the college rank and tenure committee. Then the academic vice president, then finally to me. So by the time someone's recommendation gets to me, it's been so thoroughly vetted that it would be a rare case where there'd been dissent in the decision.
Yes, but you will find a rare case every once in a while. And sooner or later, you're going to say, well, this wasn't right.
Sure, sure. And, you know, that goes with the job. When and if that happens, you got to make the best call that you can.
Mm-hmm. Well, then We see the question of student safety now. We see these terrible moments when a gunman will come onto a campus. You're the head guy. If it happens on your watch, somebody is going to be upset. So how do you prepare yourself either for it or to make sure it doesn't happen?
Yeah, it's gun violence is such a horrific problem, and so many of these mass shootings are in school settings. So we prepare, you know, constantly. The head of security leads drills and exercises. Our website has video for people to watch with instructions about the best things you can do if you find yourself in that kind of situation. You know, colleges are traditionally open campuses so that we invite members of the community to come to talks and lectures. We don't have guards checking people as they come in. Now, do we need to think about going that route? Well, not yet, but it's something we continue to talk about. In our case, you know, that would involve we'd need to put up a fence along the Hudson River because our boundary on one big side of campus is the Hudson River. So we're very diligent about it. We are always talking with other schools about best practices and trying to educate our community about how to keep safe, but it could happen anywhere, and it's deeply troubling.
So David Yellen, tell me how you feel about academic freedom. Inevitably, the New York Post is going to run a story about a college that wants to invite somebody or a student group that wants to invite somebody of great controversy, and there's all hell to pay. Alumni check in, other people say things. What do you do about that?
Yeah, and this has been one of the most topical things on college campuses for the last few years.
It was there when I went to Hunter in 1959 to 63. It was there because they wanted to invite, you know, Norman Thomas to talk, and there was hell to pay.
Right. So back in the 50s and 60s, the restrictions on free speech were generally not letting left-oriented people speak, the anecdote you just shared, or the free speech movement at Berkeley in the 60s. That was about liberal students wanting more freedom, you know, to bring liberal political and cultural figures to campus. Fast forward to the 2010s, and the argument for restricting speech is coming from the left, not coming from the right. As we've seen all around the country, there have been protests against speakers who people feel have views that are insensitive or offensive to others. You know, I and most college presidents think that free speech is a paramount value and that people should have the right to listen to speakers of a range of opinions. And if you don't like what someone has to say, you don't have to go. You can protest outside of it in a peaceful, polite way. You can organize counter speakers. You know, we're institutions of higher education. So I'm strongly on the side of free speech, even if people take offense at what someone's going to say.
Are there limits? In other words, if the guy's a Nazi, I once had one of my programs with Mario Cuomo in which he did not want the death penalty. He made it clear it may have, in fact, cost him his fourth term. However, I said, no one ever? He said, no one. And I said, Adolf Eichmann? And he got mad at me later on for that. Yeah. I mean, is there a line beyond which you just shouldn't cross?
On that point, you remember how Michael Dukakis kind of flubbed that question in a debate, talking abstractly about the death penalty when hypothetically someone had murdered his wife. And yeah. Governor Cuomo, when he was asked that question, he'd say, I would, if I could, beat that person to death with a baseball bat, but that's not what society should do. So he had a beautiful answer about that from the standpoint of a death penalty opponent. So are there limits? You know, for a public institution, the answer is essentially no, because the First Amendment to the Constitution forbids the government from making any decisions on the content of speech. So you can regulate time, place, and manner, and if there were threats by the speaker of violence, there are things that are not protected speech. For private institutions, we have legally quite a bit more latitude in how we exercise it. Yeah, there are limits. I mean, first two things. We would try and talk any professor or faculty member out of inviting someone who wasn't really trying to foster a dialogue. There are people who are out there just to spew hate. And there are people who I don't see how they contribute to a meaningful dialogue about important issues. If someone is across that line where our judgment is they're not interested in ideas, they're just interested in hate, I would support not wanting that person on campus. The harder question are people who clearly have intellectual academic credentials, but say things that are really offensive to a lot of people. And there, you know, I'm on the free speech side, and I think we should be the home to those kind of debates, even hearing uncomfortable things said.
I just sat down and wrote a letter of recommendation for a remarkable young man. I wonder, are you ever pressured in your job as president, or have you ever seen it done, where, you know, you think the admissions process is tough, but, you know, fair, and we shouldn't take this kid, and all of a sudden you hear from somebody who gives you a lot of money? How do you deal with that?
Oh, you have lots of conversations like that, but I've never felt pressure from anybody. You know, there's nothing wrong with, for a private institution, taking into account, you know, there's a whole range of things that someone might bring by admitting them. And in the real world, someone who's attached to someone really important to the college, you're going to give them some extra consideration. I got no problem with that at all. I would have a big problem if someone, you know, tried to exercise coercion over the admissions process. And in all my years as a law school dean and now as a college president, I happily have not had that experience.
Can you tell us what your techniques are for saying to a potential donor, this is why you should give us money?
You don't ask someone for money cold. It's not like a politician who is sort of required by their staff to go in a room X hours a day and make these cold calls, or people they met once asking for money. In the college environment, it's really about building a relationship. So when you meet someone who's a person of means, you begin a discussion about their life, the college, what our aspirations are. So by the time you actually ask them for a gift, they have shown they're really interested in the college. They know the request is coming, whatever their answer is going to be. So it really is a conversation more than an ask. And that winds up being, in general, a really fun part of the job because, look, you need those transformative gifts to really build your institution. And when someone who has all these choices about what to do with their hard-earned money decides to invest in your institution, that's incredibly satisfying.
But there still is that moment when the ask has to be put forward. In other words, can you do it? And there are some people who are quite good at it, and then there are some people who really are adverse to it.
Yeah, when I first became a law school dean, that did not come naturally to me. I was very comfortable talking to people, but making that leap to saying, so what do you think about giving us, you know, fill-in-the-blank dollars for this wonderful thing? That was hard at the beginning. And I know there are people for whom it's easy, and there are people who never can do it. For me, I was more in the normal range of people for whom, you know, there were some gulp moments and had to get better at it over time, but then it gets a lot easier.
And of course, if they're in the room with you, they pretty well know what you want to do.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. So, Alan, can I talk to you about something you really might like to support at Marist? We'll do that later.
Absolutely. So, listen, I love talking to you because you are so smart. And, you know, that's what we really need. I have to say that we have people on our radio station, a conservative bent. One guy, Herb London, is on once a week for 4 minutes. And we hear from people who say, get him off of our radio station. Get him off of our radio station. We don't care. We think it's very important. You think this country is becoming so polarized that we may never get back?
That is a real danger. The level of polarization, I'm not the one observing this, everybody knows this, the level of polarization is pretty unprecedented. Let's go back to when I worked in Congress in the 80s. You know, there was, obviously, this was the Reagan administration. There was huge tension between Democrats and Republicans. But famously, that was the era when President Reagan and Speaker Tip O'Neill could insult each other all day and then get together for a drink and a laugh at the end of the day. And that's just so much healthier. And because of a lot of reasons and forces and factors that you and public radio listeners are well aware of, that's not happening today, and we need to try and get that back to some extent.
I only have a couple of minutes, but you're a Jewish guy who gets to be the president of Marist College, which is certainly not sectarian now, is non-sectarian, but When you took that job, did it ever occur to you that that this might be a problem?
Well, I was dean for 11 years at Loyola Chicago Law School, which is a Jesuit Catholic law school, and it was such a wonderful, comfortable environment. I loved being there. I loved the Jesuits I got to know. I had 11 years in Catholic higher education. Marist is not a Catholic college any longer and hasn't been for over 40 years. It was founded by Marist Brothers, and there's still a deep connection between the college and the Marist Brothers. But that's a real plus for Marist as a place, because the Marist Brothers, like the Jesuits, their founding ethos is about education and community and service. So it really infuses Marist with an identity that's really valuable. So I am the first, I'm only the fourth president, I'm the first non-Catholic president of Marist. So it was a cultural moment for the college, but it's been great.
When you were interviewed, did anybody get to that question?
Yeah, we talked about it. We talked about it, because certainly some of the older alums who were there when it was a Catholic college have a certain set of expectations for the place that even as it's changed over the years. So we talked about it because we needed to be mutually comfortable.
We've been in conversation today with Marist College President David Yellen. David, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this. I mean, it's always great to hear a guy who thinks about things and who knows what he's doing, and you certainly are that. And we appreciate it very much. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.